Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hoax, The Popish Plot That Never Was, by Victor Stater. Narrated by John Lee. Introduction. People can believe preposterous things. In our own century, many believe that a pedophile ring has seized control of the American government. Others are convinced that the Kremlin succeeded in electing a president of the United States who was an intelligence asset to them. In the last century, some people believed that the British royal family had murdered Diana, Princess of Wales, in 1997, and that the Elders of Zion plotted world domination for Jewry. It has always been so. Believing conspiracy theories is part of human nature, and believers are not necessarily stupid. We credit the preposterous because it often confirms our own bias. It is easy to believe that an enemy is an unprincipled conspirator. We often do not stop to examine the presumptions of the like-minded, and we too often refuse to accept the rational explanations of those who disagree with us. This book tells the story of one of the most preposterous and consequential conspiracy theories of all time. It threatened a renewal of civil war in Britain, but in the end it ushered in a new political model instead of war. Two political parties competing, more or less peacefully, for power. The story is one of ruthless opportunism, naivety, cruelty, and astonishing self-sacrifice. In the summer of 1678, a half-mad English clergyman, with an obsessive hatred of Jesuits, met a shifty vagabond, with a past so full of misdeeds and scandal that showing his remarkably ugly face in public was an act of courage. The clergyman was Israel Tongue, and the vagabond was Titus Oates. The two of them concocted a story intended to gain them notoriety, and, with luck, a living. There was, they claimed, a diabolical conspiracy, led by prominent Catholics, both lay and clerical, to kill King Charles II. The plot, they described in its first iteration, involved the king's assassination, followed by a Catholic uprising. There would be elaborations, but this was the original outline of their story, and it was enough to spark a political crisis and send many wholly innocent people to their death. Why did this incredible story have such an impact? Neither Tongue nor Oates exuded credibility, though Oates at least made up for that with a grating self-confidence that might have passed for credibility in some quarters. In the beginning, the conspirators had trouble gaining attention, but happily for them, and disastrously for many others, events turned in their favour in the late summer and early autumn of 1678. Political tensions had been growing in England for years. The joy that had greeted the restored monarchy in 1660 had curdled by the mid-1670s. King Charles was good-natured, indolent, and fickle, more interested in a quiet life pursuing his pleasures, some of dubious morality. Power shifted into and out of the hands of a cast of characters whose ambitions often outweighed their talents. In matters of religion, Charles sought to ease tensions between former supporters of Cromwell's regime, who tended to lean towards Puritanism, and the High Church Anglicanism dear to Royalists. Twice, in 1662 and 1672, he tried to remove penalties against those who chose to worship outside the Church of England. The strong opposition these indulgences provoked meant that both were quickly withdrawn. Some detected a growing Catholic influence at court, a real danger for Charles, and more crucially for his brother James, the heir apparent. More than a century after Henry VIII broke with Rome, anti-Catholicism remained a powerful force in Protestant England. Yet Charles, after spending years in exile under the protection of his Catholic cousin, Louis XIV, remained on good terms with him. Many English Protestants feared Louis even more than the Pope. Charles had married a Catholic, and several of his influential mistresses were Catholic. Worst of all, the king's brother James, Duke of York, had converted to Catholicism by the early 1670s. As it became increasingly clear that Queen Catherine would bear no children, Protestants feared that the throne would pass to James, and a Catholic dynasty would henceforth rule England. This was the context within which Oates and Tongue emerged with their tale of popish skullduggery. What allowed the wild stories about assassinations and royal ambushes to spiral out of control was a combination of coincidence, the death of a London magistrate, the discovery of some mysterious letters, and unexpected revelations about the size of London's Catholic underground and politics, for a number of high-ranking politicians seized upon the plot as a tool to advance their own personal interests. The Lord Treasurer, Thomas, Earl of Danby, hoped he might exploit the plot to build support within a parliament that had become increasingly fractious. But more important than Danby was Anthony, Earl of Shaftesbury. An unscrupulous opportunist, in this he and Oates were born partners, he had, during the course of his life, served, quite ably, Charles I, Oliver Cromwell, and Charles II. He had been a central part of the King's government in the early 1670s, but had been ousted from power by Danby. The Little Earl, as Shaftesbury was called because of his short stature, intended to use the plot to return to the centre of power, perhaps even to displace James, for whom he had an abiding loathing. Charles II's apparent weaknesses played an important part in the unfolding of the plot. The king was, though historians have rarely noted it, Britain's first modern monarch. He pursued an interest in the emerging scientific revolution, chartering the Royal Society and spending time tinkering in his own chemical laboratory. His foreign policy was less dynastic than cognizant of a national interest defined by international trade and empire, hence his two wars against Europe's leading trading power, the Dutch Republic. He wore his religion lightly, as his attempts to indulge dissenters showed. At home he supported and fostered commerce, appointing a council of trade and plantations and supporting the malign work of the Royal Africa Company. In this work, Charles's modernity manifests itself most notably in his politics. The plot forced the king to respond politically, and he did so with a strikingly modern attitude. He became, in effect, the leader of a political party. Using the power of patronage, sponsoring favourable propaganda, and through the use of his own personal charm, campaigning before the public at civic banquets, he strove to repel the determined attacks of his political enemies. Few expected that Charles could or would respond to a political crisis with fortitude or determination. And what came to be known as the Popish Plot created a crisis, for by the late autumn of 1678 it had developed into a struggle over the succession. James became a target of the plotters who hoped to remove him from the succession. Much of the further development of the plot revolved around this struggle. By 1681, the kingdom was hopelessly divided between exclusionists, committed to James's destruction, and Yorkists, who maintained his right to the throne. The Whigs, so called by their enemies, who compared them to Scottish radicals of the same name, squared off against the Tories, dubbed by their enemies after the Catholic bandits infesting the Irish countryside. The Whigs had no qualms whatever about inflating the public sphere of Catholicism, and, by extension, James. Sending innocent people to their death did not bother them, and eventually it would not bother many Tories either. This book tells the story of the Popish plot from the moment of its unfolding. It does so with very close attention to the chronology of events and to the actions and statements, many of them under oath, of the main participants. It is a narrative rather than an analytic account of the plot. Although the tale is based on years of research in the archives and printed sources, notes are kept to a minimum to allow the listeners to absorb themselves in the story without distraction. It is crucial for understanding this preposterous story that listeners experience the fear, loathing, blind prejudice, and outright lying that took place in the eventful 3 years that changed the course of British history. The plot was crucial as a political catalyst. It enabled the formation of what would become a two-party political system. It triggered an explosion of political propaganda, giving rise to a partisan press that has been an enduring feature of Anglo-American political life ever since. No one knew it at the time, but this form of political competition would become an essential element of politics throughout the English-speaking world. Party politics were born in an atmosphere of cruelty and injustice. Politicians, particularly Whigs, sacrificed innocent lives in the pursuit of their goals. It was an ugly process, but crucially, it provided a framework for competition that would actually lessen the chances of civil war in a nation where political passions had already triggered one just 3.5 decades earlier. And it all started because of the squalid ambitions of one very bad man, Titus Oates. Prologue. The death of William Staley. November 1678. William Staley was the first victim, though he would certainly not be the last. He lived with his father, John, and sister, near Covent Garden, where he worked in the family trade as a goldsmith. The Staleys were prosperous, if not fabulously rich. Goldsmithing was a profitable, if risky, trade. The risks lay not so much in the fashioning of gold into luxurious household ornaments and jewellery as in a more recent sideline, banking. The Staleys, like other much richer families, took deposits from customers. Their premises were secure. They were well versed in the art and science of precious metals and jewels. It made sense for them to offer this facility for clients. Trusting that their deposits would be readily available on demand, and not subject to the danger of casual housebreakers or dishonest servants, wealthy ladies and gentlemen carried their bags of gold to be locked up in the strong chests and cellars of the goldsmiths. Goldsmiths earned a profit by loaning out some of their deposits, usually charging substantial rates of interest. As long as everyone remained honest and unforeseen disasters could be avoided, the arrangement was quite satisfactory. The Staleys prospered in this way, but while always subject to the usual risks of the business, they added one more. They were Roman Catholic. Catholics, despised by many of their neighbours and subject to a wide range of discriminatory laws, preferred to keep their private affairs, especially their money affairs, within the faith. A Catholic goldsmith could be expected to protect his co-religionist's secrets, for there were many of these, especially among wealthy Catholics. Assets that might be subject to seizure under a variety of discriminatory laws were hidden behind phalanxes of trustees and complicated blind trusts. John Staley knew how these things were done, and he knew to whom to turn when a new trust or new arrangements were needed. For wealthy Catholics, dealing with the Staleys was a comfort. Moreover, it gave them a ready-made set of customers, whose loyalty could be relied upon. John Staley had earned a good reputation. He had well-placed, influential friends, Catholic and Protestants alike. He lived in a fashionable part of town, close to wealthy families who frequently needed his services, and made a good living. In due course, his son William would take over the business. In 1678, William was probably in his 20s. He had been educated abroad, in a Jesuit school that catered to the families of English Catholics, hoping to keep their faith strong from one generation to the next. The practice was strictly illegal. Parliament had long ago outlawed it, but the government rarely enforced the statute. As a result, William spent much of his youth in Europe, travelling in France and Italy, where he learned the languages. Good preparation for the family banking business. After his return, he settled down to help his father. In mid-November 1678, the business that had sustained the Staleys was threatened by one of those dreaded unforeseen events— widespread rumours of a Catholic political conspiracy. Catholics were, not surprisingly, nervous, and many rushed to secure the wealth they had left in the Staleys' hands. Something of an undercover run, for Catholics did not care to let everyone know they were fearful, had begun. On the 14th of November, William and one of his customers, an elderly Italian named Benjamin Fromante, were in the Black Lion cookshop, close to Covent Garden. While they were speaking together, at about 11 a.m., three men walked into the shop and ordered pots of ale and slices of roast beef. Shops like the Black Lion were the fast food restaurants of their day. They were ubiquitous and always had some hearty fare available at any time, roast or boiled meat being favourite choices. As the three men awaited their meal, their attention was drawn to the two men in the next room, some 7 or 8 feet away. The fact that they spoke in animated French was eye-opening. Many of the latest rumours and tales of Catholic skullduggery involved mysterious French agents, and so the customers immediately pricked up their ears. And what they heard, or thought they heard, astounded them. The old man was saying that the English king persecuted the people of God. The younger man agreed, and passionately stamping his foot on the floor, called Charles II a great heretic, and clapping his hand upon his chest said, "I myself will kill him." In the atmosphere of suspicion and panic that had been rapidly building in London over the previous weeks, these words shocked the witnesses, or two of them at any rate, since one, Philip Garrett, knew no French, though the others, Captain William Carstairs and Alexander Sutherland, did. Carstairs in particular was outraged, and determined not to allow the episode to pass. Shortly after overhearing the remarks, the two unknown Frenchmen disappeared into the streets. Carstairs did not know who they were, but he quickly sent a servant after the two men to follow them. He soon learned that one of the two had been followed to the home of John Staley, goldsmith. It was Staley's son, William. Carstairs and his friends had no intention of allowing a dangerous papist to run free after threatening the king's life. Without a warrant from a justice of the peace, Carstairs could not accost William, even in the atmosphere of alarm created by rumoured Catholic plots. Legal forms must be maintained. Early the next morning, Sutherland turned up at the Staley shop, posing as a customer in the market for a jewelled button. Unfortunately, this dodge had little effect. William said that they had no such articles in stock, and Sutherland would be better off seeking out a jeweller at the Royal Exchange, the centre of that trade. Sutherland's aim was to keep William occupied until Carstairs could return with a warrant and a constable, but his gambit having failed, he was forced to leave the shop. 15 minutes later, Sutherland returned with a new ploy. Would William join him at the nearby Crossed Keys Tavern? An honourable person wanted to speak with him. Hoping, no doubt, that he was about to meet a wealthy potential customer, William agreed. At the Crossed Keys, he met a man, either Carstairs or Gifford, who proceeded to give him a glass of wine. Several, it seems, between 8 a.m. and 11, according to the tavern keeper, these gentlemen consumed 5 bottles and a great many ceremonies. And so the trap was sprung, baited by free wine and an order of roast beef, the latter of which was never consumed. At about 11 a.m, a constable arrived bearing a warrant for William's arrest. It had taken more than 2 hours to find someone with the proper authority. In the end, the witnesses had to go all the way to Whitehall, where they obtained the signature of the Secretary of State himself, Sir Joseph Williamson, and another magistrate, Sir Gilbert Gerard. Carstairs and his friends now accused William of treason and presented him with a written account of what they had heard the day before. William denied everything. "I do not understand you. I am innocent. You must not put any bubble on me." The bewildered Staley was carried off to jail, first in the Gatehouse Prison, a jail attached to Westminster Abbey, and then, the next day, he was moved to Newgate. This, at least, unlike the decrepit Gatehouse, was a new building, designed by Sir Christopher Wren in the aftermath of the Great Fire of 1666. When one of the Staley maids arrived at the Cross Keys, later in the morning, sent by John, now anxious about his son, she found him gone and learned of his arrest. When the 17th-century criminal law cranked into gear, it moved swiftly. Gilbert Burnet, Bishop of Salisbury, knew William's accusers, profligate wretches. Carstairs was a professional informer, not above extortion. Burnet sent word to the Attorney General and Lord Keeper in an attempt to forestall the prosecution. "I wished they would not rush too hastily to the taking men's lives upon such testimonies." But he found the minister's minds made up. The Attorney General accused Burnet of trying to curry favour at court and pressed on with preparations for a quick trial. On the 20th of November, William was arraigned on a charge of high treason in the Court of King's Bench in Westminster Hall. Sir William Scroggs, Lord Chief Justice, would preside, and when the arraignment was finished, Scroggs licensed Robert Paulet, a London printer, to publish an official account of the trial set for the following day. William's predicament was not his alone. Word of his arrest had spread to his customers, some of whom panicked, fearing the loss of their money. The law was clear. Convicted traitors forfeited all their property to the Crown, and no one wanted their own assets swept away with whatever William might have. After he was returned to Newgate, William received a visit from 2 gentlemen who pressed him to sign a document that would prevent the loss of their £1,000 investment. How the dejected young man received these visitors can easily be imagined. The following morning, Thursday, Staley was brought once again to Westminster Hall. He would have been familiar with the place. The principal common law courts all met in this ancient barn of a building, and it housed a wide array of booksellers and peddlers of all sorts. Dealers in money, like William, would have been in and out of the hall constantly, and he might well have stopped to hear the occasional interesting or notorious criminal case. The courts conducted their business in the open, King's Bench cases being heard at one end of the large open room. But now it was William's turn to be notorious, and there was a large audience waiting to watch the trial. The crier called the court to order. Justice Scroggs assumed his seat, overlooking the crowd, and the proceedings began. The first task was to empanel a jury. This case was a particularly important one, being prosecuted by no other than Sir Cresswell Levens, the King's Attorney General. Therefore, the jurors would be more substantial characters than men who might be chosen in a run-of-the-mill felony prosecution. 12 were seated, and they were indeed substantial. 5 were knights, and 7 esquires. Some might have known William or his family. Several lived barely a stone's throw away from the Staleys. Sir Philip Matthews and Sir Richard Blake, a prominent surgeon, both lived very near Covent Garden. William had the right to challenge jurors, but he allowed all the gentlemen called to be seated. Perhaps he thought his family's respectable reputation might work to his advantage among some of his near neighbours. William's indictment was read, and the Attorney General, who had had perhaps 3 or 4 days to prepare his case, began. Staley had threatened the King's life, a clear violation of the treason statute that Parliament passed in 1663. He had, as the law required, spoken advisedly and maliciously, and there were witnesses to prove his words. Staley's rage against the King was founded, Levin said, in his religion, and spurred on by his anger over the effect that tales of Catholic plots was having on his business. William's Jesuit education prepared him for acting the assassin, for the order had been steeped in treachery and murder from its foundation. Then followed the Crown's principal witnesses, Carstairs, Sutherland, and Garrett. The first two recounted what they had heard in the Black Lion. Garrett, not understanding French, affirmed their account, though he could not testify to William's precise words. After the prosecution finished its questions, William was given an opportunity to interrogate the witnesses, though he did not shake their stories. One Catholic version of the proceedings says that Staley claimed his accusers had attempted to extort £200 from him before calling a constable, though the fact does not appear in the authorised account of the trial. Staley argued that the witnesses must have misunderstood his French. He had been talking of the French king, and moreover had never threatened to kill any king at all, but rather himself. The latter claim prompted an intervention from Justice Scroggs on the bench. Would you kill yourself because you said the King of France was a great heretic? It is easy to imagine that this question was put in a less than sympathetic manner. In theory, criminal defendants were not allowed legal counsel because the judge played that role. In practice, as in this case, that was far from true. William claimed that he and Fromante had in fact been comparing England and France, and condemning Louis XIV as a tyrant, though not, he said, a heretic. He had never used that word. Moreover, I have been thought a person of some intelligence and some understanding in the world. Would such a person speak treasonous words in public before a crowd of strangers? He then reiterated his claim that he had been talking of suicide, not regicide. Once again, Scroggs interjected a hostile comment. What Jesuit taught you this trick? It is like one of them. It is the art and interest of a Jesuit so to do. A key part of William's defence would have been the testimony of Benjamin Fromante, but he was not in the court. Another handicap defendants faced was that they, unlike the Crown, could not compel a witness to testify. We cannot know why Fromante was not present, but the Attorney General did have a written statement from him. This he gave to William, and asked him if he wished to enter it in evidence in his defence. Curiously, William did not. Evidently, Fromante's statement did not seem to be helpful. The fact that it was apparently procured by the prosecution perhaps makes William's response less than surprising. Staley called one witness, a Protestant gentleman who remained nameless in the printed account of the trial. He had on many occasions heard William say positive, loyal things about Charles II and bitter negatives about the Jesuits. William had expressed horror about the alleged Catholic plot on everyone's lips as well. But the witness had not been present at the Black Lion on the 14th of November, and therefore could not say anything about the actual words William had spoken. Here again, Scroggs placed his thumb on the scale of justice, belittling the witness's testimony. That is when he, Staley, spoke to a Protestant. The evidence having been presented, it was the judge's turn to sum up for the jury. He was no less biased in his summation than he had been during the presentation of the case. After bitterly attacking the principles of the Society of Jesus, he dwelt on Staley's calling the king a great heretic. When a papist once hath made a man a heretic, there is no scruple to mather him. Whosoever is not of their persuasion are heretics, and whoever are heretics may be martyred, if the Pope commands it, for then they may become saints in heaven. Therefore, speaking to the jury, discharge your consciences as you ought to do. If guilty, you shall do well to begin with this man, for perchance it may be a terror to the rest. The jurors, without leaving their places, returned a guilty verdict almost immediately. With the verdict rendered, the final act of the courtroom drama played out. William was asked, "What have you to say for yourself, wherefore the court should not proceed to judgment against you?" "I have nothing to say." Justice Scroggs then pronounced judgment. "You seem, instead of being sorrowful, to be obstinate. Between God and your conscience be it. I have nothing to do with it. It is my duty to pronounce judgment upon you, which is this. You shall return to the prison, from thence be drawn to the place of execution, where you shall be hanged by the neck, cut down alive. Your quarters shall be severed and disposed of as the king shall think fit, and your bowels burnt. And so the Lord have mercy on your soul." And so William returned to Newgate to await his end, which was not long in coming. His execution was set for Tuesday, the 26th of November. In the 5 days remaining to him, he was visited by his father and sister, who no doubt offered what comfort they could, and who were also concerned about the whereabouts of some of their customers' money and jewels. The Anglican chaplain at Newgate, Samuel Smith, prayed with William, but had no luck converting him to Protestantism. On his last day, William told Smith that he was reconciled to death, but he was worried that the pain of his execution might spur him to curse or use any unchristian word. Dressed in a sober and expensive black suit, a fashionable periwig and silk stockings, William was tied around the chest to a straw-covered sledge drawn by 4 horses. He looked around him at the huge crowd of onlookers as the horses dragged him to Tyburn. It would have taken some time, as the distance was over 1 mile, and the way crowded with people. He was surrounded by a large number of constables and watchmen for fear of a rescue attempt, but none happened. He mounted the scaffold and spoke his last words, and seemed willing to extenuate his guilt by alleging he had no treasonous intention. The executioner's grisly work began. It ended with him lifting William's bloody heart high above the thick crowd and shouting, "Here is the heart of a traitor!" William's gory remains were heaped upon the sledge. The need for the straw was now apparent, and returned to town. At some point, the family had used its influence and obtained 1 small, very small mercy, from the crown. William's remains were returned to them, and he was allowed Christian burial, rather than the customary humiliation of a public display of the head and quarters on the city gates or London Bridge. Within hours of William's death, London's printers were busily composing accounts of his trial and execution, including 1 luridly illustrated broadside ballad, "Treason, Justly Punished." "O stay and lend an ear, you loyal subjects all, and by this story you shall hear, behold, a traitor's fall." Was William Staley really guilty of treason? Perhaps. He might have made threatening comments about Charles II, whose government he might have held responsible for the panicked withdrawals being made by his customers. Or perhaps, threatened with financial ruin, he really was talking of suicide. More likely, he was the victim of the unscrupulous Carstairs, who saw him as a potential meal ticket for a time. We will never know. But another question arises. Why did the Crown see fit to prosecute a young man of good family and reputation when worse things were said about the King and his government on a daily basis? And why make the case such a high priority, assigning it to the Attorney General? The answer seems clear. The government was losing control. Fears of Catholic conspiracies were rampant, rumour and charges of treason emerging at all hands, and the government's political enemies were beginning to exploit those fears for their own ends. When Bishop Burnet protested that Carstairs was a perjured villain, Lord Shaftesbury, leading the charge against Lord Treasurer Danby, said, "We must support the evidence, and that all those who undermined the credit of the witnesses were to be looked on as public enemies." The case against William Staley was necessary because it demonstrated that the King's ministers were doing something. William was sacrificed, innocent or guilty made no difference, because he was available and Catholic. His trial was evidence that the government was in charge and was capable of defending the king and defeating the papists. Only time would tell whether this impression would endure. 1. Politics and Popery. 6.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?